And here's a follow-up to the dramatic scandal at Olympus, which we've been following on this program. It's one of Japan's most respected corporations, or it was. Now executives from Olympus are facing criminal charges and prison sentences. The company may be delisted from the Tokyo Stock Exchange and may also go bankrupt. All this after revelations of dubious acquisitions and allegations of massive accounting fraud. From Tokyo, Lucy Kraft has more.
Olympus Corporation has been in business for almost a century. And while not as famous overseas as Toyota, Sony, or Nintendo, until recently, no company seemed to more perfectly embody its own name. In one way or another, Olympus products reach nearly every Japanese citizen. While its digital cameras are losing ground, the company has carved out a reputation for technical excellence in medical equipment. So when news broke that for 20 years, Olympus executives had been cooking the books, that the company may be in hock for over $1 billion, Christina Amagian, who studies corporate governance in Japan, couldn't believe her ears.
Complete shock. It just didn't compute that something, I mean, the reputation of Olympus has been such a high quality, good, responsible company that hearing this just did not compute at all.
Japanese police and financial regulators are still sorting out the mess, but observers say it all began in the mid-1980s. Olympus began to founder after moves to weaken the dollar suddenly made Japanese exports less competitive. Anxious to beef up its bottom line, Olympus followed the crowd, according to Shuhei Abe, president of the Sparks Group hedge fund.
They went into what they call Zaiteku, that's financially investing their idle cash to make up their slowing down earnings.
And this was quite common among many.
It was very common. Everyone did it, and if you didn't do it, management were considered to be a bit outdated.
But when Japan's bubble economy burst, and later when finance regulators tightened rules on accounting, Olympus didn't do what most other Japanese companies did. It never came clean on its losses, choosing instead to hide its mistakes with a series of overpriced acquisitions using Cayman Islands-based companies. The Olympus scandal has reinvigorated the debate over Japan's corporate governance. Most companies in the world's third largest economy have refused to put independent directors on their boards. Koji Aiba of Tokyo's Waseda University says the lack of oversight allows a Japanese CEO to ignore his shareholders with impunity.
He picks the board members from his subordinates, and he has the power to shuffle the board member. And when he goes to the shareholder meeting, he already has a proxy of more than 50% in his hand, so he doesn't really have to care.
The insider mentality at Olympus is reminiscent also of Tokyo Electric Power, whose Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant became the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Christina Amagian says the overriding instinct at such firms is to hide mistakes at all costs.
This sense that we must be loyal to our predecessors, that we can't blow the whistle, we can't criticize because of these bonds of loyalty are very similar. That's very Japanese culture.
Japan has been moving towards better disclosure in recent years. The Olympus debacle, which has put Japanese corporate governance under global scrutiny, won't transform standards overnight. It's widely expected to at least hasten moves towards reform. For NPR News, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
George and Ira Gershwin wrote some of their best songs for the movies. One of these films, A Damsel in Distress, which was released in 1937, 4 months after George died of a brain tumor, is now on DVD. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says it may be the oddest among their films.
Bad news, go away, call round someday, in March or May, I can't be bothered now, my bonds and shares may fall downstairs, who cares, I'm dancing and I can't be bothered now.
A Damsel in Distress was the third of only four films on which George and his brother Ira Gershwin collaborated. The star is Fred Astaire, but without Ginger Rogers. Their previous film together, Shall We Dance, also with an unforgettable Gershwin score, hadn't lived up to studio expectations, and the now famous stars were taking a break from each other. This film has two substitutes for Rogers, one of the best and maybe the worst. Two songs from it became standards, and Astaire's longtime assistant, choreographer Hermes Pan, won an Oscar for dance direction for one of the most delightful production numbers in a Hollywood musical. The story is based on a novel by P.G. Wodehouse, who also co-authored the screenplay. It's a mild satire on the snobbery of the British aristocracy. The heroine, the rebellious Lady Alice Marsh Morton, is played by 18-year-old Joan Fontaine, 3 years before she won an Oscar for Suspicion, the only actor ever to win an Oscar in an Alfred Hitchcock film. Her family thinks she has fallen in love with Astaire, who plays an American dancer visiting London with his publicist and his dizzy secretary, George Burns and Gracie Allen. It's directed by George Stevens, who's better known for such high dramas as A Place in the Sun, Shane, and Giant, but who had previously directed Astaire and Rogers in what many people consider their very best film, Swing Time. Here's one of the most famous songs from A Damsel in Distress, maybe the best song ever written about England.
A foggy day in London town had me low and had me down. I viewed the morning with alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wondered, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly I saw you there, and through foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere.
The British setting gives the Gershwins a chance to experiment. The score actually includes two madrigals. But the great number is an 8-minute sequence in a funhouse, in which Fred and George and Gracie slide down a chute and dance on a double turntable turning in opposite directions and in front of a series of funhouse mirrors that stretch them and shorten them and make them all legs with no bodies, a marvelously ironic image of Astaire. Burns and Allen are veteran vaudevillians, and their dancing is light as a feather, especially Gracie's hilarious nonstop trotting around that turntable like some wonderful wind-up toy. Here's the song that begins the number, deliciously introduced by Gracie.
What made Good Queen Bess such a great success? What made Wellington do what he did at Waterloo? What makes every Englishman a fighter through and through? It isn't roast beef or ale or home or mother. It's just a little thing they sing to one another. Stiff upper lip, stout fellow, carry on old bean. Chin up, keep muddling through. Stiff upper lip, stout fellow, dash it all I mean. Pip, pip to old man trouble and a toodaloo-doo. Carry on through thick and thin. If you feel you're in the right, does the fighting spirit win? Oh, quite, 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 quite. Stiff upper lip, stout fella, when you're in a stew. Sober up, lotto, this is the motto. Keep muddling through.
The main problem with the film is that Fontaine was not a dancer. So the only romantic dance number in the film takes place in a woodland setting, and whenever possible, Fontaine is hidden by trees. It may be the only Astaire musical that doesn't end with a duet. The other great song in the film is Nice Work If You Can Get It, with Astaire simultaneously dancing and playing drums with his feet. Here's the song before he starts tapping.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath a starry sky.
Whoa.
Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sigh and sigh after sigh.
Boy, it is.
Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try, if you
Imagine a time in Hollywood when there were so many good movie songs that neither A Foggy Day nor Nice Work If You Can Get It was nominated for a Best Song Oscar. In fact, George Gershwin's only Oscar nomination was from the same year, another song introduced by Fred Astaire, They Can't Take That Away From Me, from Shall We Dance. But it lost to a Hawaiian number called Sweet Leilani that Bing Crosby made popular. It would be my nomination for the worst decision ever made by the Motion Picture Academy.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches in the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the new DVD of A Damsel in Distress. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward talks about Hillbilly Boogie, a hybrid of boogie-woogie and country that caught on after World War II and was a precursor to rock and roll. This is Fresh Air.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. New Orleans has become the center of an education revolution. More than 70% of public school students there attend a charter school, and the number of kids remaining in traditional public schools is shrinking fast. As this experiment moves forward, New Orleans has confronted questions that dog the charter school movement nationwide. Are charters welcoming the most challenging students, especially those in special education? NPR's Larry Abramson has the story.
Parents in post-Katrina New Orleans can pick and choose from a smorgasbord of schools with different approaches, different cultures. By many measures, this educational marketplace has improved student achievement, especially in the city's many charter schools. But has performance for some come at the expense of other students?
No, what are you listening to right now? An MP3 player? Would you like to go play the piano?
Though Noah Fisher is 10 years old, he still listens to nursery rhymes. That's just one indication of the profound challenges he faces.
Noah's been diagnosed with autism. He's also blind, and he also has some feeding issues and developmentally delayed.
Kelly Fisher, Noah's mother, says when her family moved down to New Orleans in 2009, they expected Noah would need the same kind of intensive help that he got at his old school in Indiana. For help in finding the right school, they turned to the Recovery School District, the state-run agency that is the closest thing New Orleans has to a traditional district.
Because I came from a traditional program, I thought, oh, that's my local special ed coordinator. That's the person that knows what's in the city and can direct me towards the schools that would be best for Noah.
But the Fishers say New Orleans' open choice system left them totally on their own when it came to finding a school for Noah. In theory, they could find any charter they wanted, but the best charters are full, so they ended up on waiting lists. Father Bob Fisher says the central district seemed powerless.
The director was just scrambling around, making phone calls, actually at one point ran out in the hallway and grabbed somebody and said, hey, do you have an opening at your school?
The Fishers say they kept looking for a school that could help Noah. Finally, they ended up at Lafayette Academy, a charter school.
Where's that button?
Here, Noah has a full-time aide named Daniel Thomas. He and Noah are taking a break from class, walking outside on a nice fall day.
Sweep your cane, there's a big crack in the sidewalk.
Does she ask you to come in? Billy boy.
At Lafayette, the Fishers say Noah has the help he needs. They suspect that other schools simply did not want to spend the money needed to hire an aide and were not interested in accommodating Noah. Lafayette principal Mickey Landry admits it is challenging for any school to cover the costs of special ed.
The state tops out its financing for special needs students at about $18,000 a year. But some students cost us significantly more than that, sometimes as much as $40,000.
You can't say, sorry, we can only provide $18,000 worth of services?
Oh, that's right. We do whatever we have to do for a child. That's right.
Landry says he simply found a way to give Noah the support he needs. According to many parents, other schools do not work as hard to follow the law, which says all schools must be open to all students. The Fishers have joined a class action lawsuit charging that the New Orleans school system excludes special ed students. Eden Heilman, a staff attorney with the Southern Poverty Law Center, is suing the Louisiana Department of Education, which set up the post-Katrina school system.
the state kind of abandoned their responsibilities to students with disabilities in New Orleans. I mean, in any other school district where, for example, you have one single district, you have to do things like monitoring and compliance reviews.
But Superintendent John White says that's changing. White just took over as superintendent for the Recovery School District a few months ago. He points out that test scores for special education have improved dramatically since Katrina and that these children were terribly neglected before the storm. But he admits those scores are still much lower than they should be. White says it is tough for his agency to oversee a system of independent schools.
I think it's fair to say that a market system always has the challenges of how do we ensure that the most vulnerable, the most traditionally underserved, are served well in that system.
White is putting a series of reforms in place. They're supposed to show whether some schools are experiencing high turnover because they're pushing students away. Many educators in New Orleans say the parents' complaints ignore the other side of this unique education system, the creativity the charters have brought.
All right.
This is KIPP New Orleans Leadership Primary School in the city's French Quarter. The special ed enrollment here is about 9%, similar to the city average. KIPP has posted some of the most impressive gains in the city. The school says its mission includes kids like 8-year-old Benjamin Camp.
Hi, Mom. I love you, too. I love you.
Benjamin is sweet, but he's had behavior problems for years and was recently diagnosed with autism. His grandmother, Carmela Camp, says some nursery schools turned Benjamin away as too challenging. But this charter school never suggested he go anywhere else.
Never, 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 ever. Still haven't heard it. He was in two schools, and they say they couldn't handle him, you know.
But KIPP has also faced charges that it pushes some students out. The school has a firm discipline policy that can be tough for some students to follow. Families must agree to a commitment to excellence, which includes getting their kids to school on time and becoming part of the education process. Rhonda Alouise, executive director of KIPP New Orleans, insists this approach doesn't exclude anyone.
So there is not this requirement, or if you come to KIPP, you must do this. This is, here's our vision for what a school can do. Come be a part of this with us.
But this is still a promise that traditional public schools seldom require. The stories of the 10 families in this suit raise questions that go well beyond New Orleans. Detroit is using New Orleans as a model for reform and has moved to citywide school choice and hopes to open dozens of charters. Many Detroit teachers have reacted, like Ivy Bailey, who spoke with me this summer.
As a public institution, we take any and every child. We know children learn at different levels. But charter schools, they can pick who they want to take. They can say, well, you know, Ms. Jones, this is not working for us. You need to take your child somewhere else.
Whatever happens with the New Orleans lawsuit, charter groups will have to wrestle with a continuing perception that they are not open to all. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block with a story about the long path back from traumatic brain injury. Listeners to this program first got to meet Arizona Democratic Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords when she had just arrived in Washington as a wide-eyed freshman, elected in 2006.
You know, I got dropped off this morning at the airport in a 63 Chevy pickup truck, got my cowboy boots, met up with my fiancé, life's good, and it's very, very excited. It's so optimistic about taking our country in a new direction.
4 years after that, on January 8th of this year, Gabrielle Giffords was shot in the head as she met with constituents in Tucson. She was one of 13 people injured that day. 6 people were killed. The story of Giffords' recovery from that traumatic brain injury is told in a new book titled Gabby, A Story of Courage and Hope. It's told in her husband Mark Kelly's voice, but the last chapter, about half a page long, is in Gabby Giffords' voice, and we hear her reading that part of the audiobook.
hope, and faith. You have to have hope and faith. Everything I do reminds me of that horrible day.
Congresswoman Gifford spent 5 months in the hospital. Now she does hours of rigorous physical and speech therapy every day and has full-time nursing care. I met Gabrielle Giffords and Mark Kelly at their home outside Houston. He's an astronaut, a former shuttle commander, recently retired from NASA. Congresswoman Giffords greeted me with a huge, radiant smile and a shake of her left hand. She still has only limited use of her right arm. She was wearing a T-shirt given to her by another survivor of a gunshot wound to the head. On the front, the shirt says, "Got hope?" And on the back, it says, "I do." Gabrielle Giffords repeated that word, "hope, hope, hope," she told me, with a little pump of her working fist. Giffords' language is still halting. I heard mostly one- or two-word thoughts, and she was not made available for an interview. Instead, I sat down with Mark Kelly to talk about his wife's injury and her recovery. He told me about one awful, panicked moment a month after the attack. His wife was in the hospital in Houston. She hadn't yet spoken a word.
One of Gabby's nurses just said, "Hey, Mark, you got to come here quickly." Gabby was sitting in her wheelchair in the bathroom with just this look of terror on her face, tears streaming down her face, hyperventilating. And she was trying to say something and really couldn't. She just now realized, this was the moment she realized that she couldn't speak. You know, before that, she was in this long, hazy period of just coming out of the coma and just recovering from her injuries. But at this moment, it was the light bulb came on, and it's like, I cannot speak. And am I going to be trapped like this forever? And that's what she was going through, and it was it was difficult period of time.
And what did you do?
I just held her, and I told her it was going to get better. I was going to help her through this, and she has a lot of people that care for her and love her, and that we were going to get through this, and it's going to get better. It did. It did.
Language recovery has come slowly. Mark Kelly thinks back on the moment he first heard his wife utter a word.
At first, we weren't sure if it was a word. And then she said it a couple more times. You know, she said the word "what" over and over again. It was like, "What? What? 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 What?" And I don't know, we don't know if it meant what's happened. And then it was clear she wasn't really asking a question. It was more as just her, I think the speech part of her brain just booting up, like a computer boots up for the first time, and that's the spot it booted up at.
You use the analogy in the book that a brain injury is like a hurricane. Can you explain how that manifests itself?
You know, it's like the drawer of the filing cabinet came open, and all the files kept blown up in the air, and some of them fell back right into the correct place. Some of them fell in the wrong place, and some of them are gone forever. And I see that with Gabby. Her memory is really good, but sometimes when she looks for the correct word, she'll get the wrong word. Sometimes the correct word is there. And then sometimes it's in the wrong place, but I've come to learn that your brain can rewire itself to some extent, and she can find where those words are now located. So it is like a hurricane.
You describe in the book that Congresswoman Giffords couldn't formulate a question for many months, for about 6 months after the shooting, which really raises all sorts of thoughts about how you two could communicate during that time. You sort of can't think about how vital it is to be able to
ask a question.
Ask a question.
It never occurred to me before. It's very difficult to carry on a conversation. It becomes very one-sided. In the beginning, the ability for her to ask me something, anything, was very significant.
Do you remember the first question, the real question that she asked?
Yeah. She asked, "How was my day?" And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a response to something like, you know, you say, "How are you?" And it's, "I'm fine, how are you?"
Like a reflex.
Yeah, exactly. It was more of a real question, asking me how my day was today. It's a big event. It was so big to me, completely like locked my brain up. I could not remember one thing I did that day.
Really?
So I had a hard time answering her So she had this momentous event where she finally asked a question and I had no answer because I was just like so happy about it.
It's so poignant because it's a question that most couples, it's the most banal part of their day.
Yes.
When they come home and say, how was your day?
Yeah. And now we're back to that, you know, where we don't even think about it. And she'll ask, you know, every time I come in, she'll ask me how my day was. But the first time was a big deal.
How much progress are you seeing with language, say, over the last month or two
months? So, you know, in the beginning, I'd see sometimes progress day to day.
Yeah.
Now I'd say it's week to week. So she's improving all the time. You know, we can have a conversation. It's difficult for her. You know, she struggles. She gets frustrated. I have to remind her that that's a good thing. You know, getting frustrated is, from what I understand, is one of those things that's helped rebuild those connections in her brain, is that frustration. So we try to make sure that she's frustrated.
Hmm. Full sentences?
Yeah. The challenge for her is stringing the full sentences together. But it's improving all the time.
And physically, where is she with her recovery?
Well, she can walk. We just walked to the mailbox and back. It's going to be a while before she runs. Maybe never. I don't know. I'm hopeful. She'll be back on a bicycle, though.
Yeah?
Yeah. She used to love riding her bike around Tucson, and she'll be doing that again someday.
There are a lot of questions about Congresswoman Giffords and whether she will go back to work, seek re-election in 2012. In the book, you seem to be indicating that she will. You talk about when she goes back to work, not if she goes back to work.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I think it's very possible that she could run in 2012. We don't know yet. She'll have to make that decision sometime after the holidays, I think.
Talk me through that, because campaigns are grueling for everyone.
They are.
Much less someone with a traumatic brain injury.
She would not be the same campaigner that she was in the past. She knows that. She would not be able to keep that same grueling campaign schedule. But she was a maniac before. I mean, she was like the outlier in the amount of work she did. There's a lot of hardworking people in Congress, but I think she was one of the hardest. So she certainly wouldn't be able to keep that schedule as she had in the past. But, you know, I don't think she needs to. You know, she's a very dedicated public servant, and if she wants to get back to work and represent the people in Southern Arizona, they certainly can make the decision on Election Day.
When you think about the Gabrielle Giffords whom you knew on January 7th of this year and the woman you know now, how different are they?
Pretty much the same person. Mm-hmm. Personality-wise, exactly the same. You know, her compassion, dedication to her job and people she serves and how caring she is for other people. It's all exactly the same. The major thing that she struggles with is just the spoken language. And that's improving. You know, she reminds me every single day to deny the acceptance of failure. And she will get better. She'll get back to Arizona. She'll get back to serving her constituents. And she'll do it on her own schedule and when she's ready. But that's where she wants to be.
Mark Kelly, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The book, written with Jeffrey Zaslow, is titled Gabby, A Story of Courage and Hope. And we end with Gabrielle Giffords reading from the final page in the audiobook.
Long ways to go. Grateful to survive. It's frustrating, mentally hard, hard work. I'm trying so hard to get better. I will get stronger. I will return.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from two others who were shot on that January day in Tucson and from the father of a young man who was killed. How they're coping with the aftermath tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Now, much of the blame, of course, in this scandal has fallen on the coaches and the university at Penn State, but commentator Frank DeFord has been thinking about football itself.
As confounding as was the failure of Penn State officials to act, the consensus explaining the motives for their ignoble behavior is that, first, Joe Paterno didn't want to scar the reputation of himself or his football program, and then university executives wanted to protect the reputation of the dear old coach and his money-making team. Yet I must wonder as well how much the culture of the particular sport involved, football, abetted the conspiracy of silence. Football, you see, is our proud American throwback showcase of men being at their best, most primitive masculine. Indeed, the question of whether the sport is too brutal has always been an issue, and nowadays, of course, the subject is as prominent as ever. And always, always, the defenders of football are furious that the violence might be curtailed by do-gooders, that football will be sissified. The expression heard from the time little boys first play is that football teaches you to become a real man, to be manly. Nobody ever says that about even the most sublime baseball or basketball players. The only North American school sport that approaches football in its meanness is ice hockey. And yes, maybe just coincidentally, hockey has also experienced horrifying cases of pedophile coaches which went unreported for years. How could anyone possibly believe an abused boy that such a manly sport could produce such sexually perverted men? For football's devotees, the sport is public proof that our American men are still tougher than anyone else. Because of that reputation of machismo, that conceit, that creed, it surely becomes painful, almost traitorous, for men who love football to accept such an abject contradiction of their sport's manliness, the very rape of a little boy by a coach. Perhaps it doesn't even matter why Joe Paterno could be so insensitive and irresponsible. Even Paterno himself may not know what caused him to fail such a basic test of decency. But still, I cannot help but wonder that, no, it wasn't primarily because of his own reputation, but because of all the money Penn State football made that stopped him from acting. No, I wonder if, above all, Coach Paterno could not bear to see shame come to his beloved game of football.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each week from member station WSHU, Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.